The Fan on Demand.
.1002 on the Fan. 590. It is the Jeff Blair Show. I'm Mike Wilner sitting in today. Tomorrow I'm going to sit in on the Greg Brady Show. And then I won't be on the radio again until Monday afternoon when I'll have Brady's shift again. It's fun to get back in this seat a little bit and talk a little baseball during the winter. That's what we've been doing and what we will continue to do. We will have Jeff Blair on his own show coming up a little bit later on this hour. Also later this hour, we're going to take a look back, a little bit of the best interviews of the year done by me in Whistler. My best, anyway, Olympic interviews. We'll hear from Shelly-Ann Brown, who was a silver medalist. We'll hear from her before and after she won her silver medal, the Pickering native, former track and field standout and now Olympic bobsleigh silver medalist. We'll hear from John Montgomery, who won the first gold at Whistler. And we may also hear from one of the more eclectic alpine skiers who made the trip to Whistler. Later on, of course, our round table, Ryan Walsh and Rob Pizzo will be in here for an ex-Jays Talk producers completely improvised off-the-cuff hour of talking about something. It's going to be fun, I'll guarantee you that. But right now, we are pleased that the Blue Jays' de facto starting catcher for 2011, the rookie J.P. Arencibia, has taken some time out, dialed down from beast mode to join us here on the program. J.P., how's it going?
It's going good. I planned my beast mode around this the radio show today.
I appreciate it a great deal. And for people who don't know what beast mode in, you're not the only one who's in it. People who follow you on Twitter know that you're there. Ricky Romero's in it. Vernon Wells as well. This is just part of the workout routine of the winter.
Yeah, no, it's something that we've been just messing around with, and it's kind of stuck, and it's pretty fun. But yeah, we turn into these beasts and get after it in the weight room.
Yeah, and so tell me, tell the folks out there, what are you getting after in the weight room? What kind of stuff are you doing? What would impress us?
Today's legs. today's legs. So it's death to legs day. Legs are never fun because it's something that I try to key on just because obviously catching and stuff like that. So, other than that, it's just the regular squats. Bench press, deadlifts. I do a lot of powerlifting, for the main muscles. And I can't give away all my secrets, but that's summarizing it. That'd be it.
All right, J.P. Arencibia in the weight room, death to legs day, and we'll let you get back to that soon. But I want to talk a little bit about last season and about what's coming up. And first of all, I guess what the Blue Jays have done over the winter behind the plate is not much. They picked up Jose Molina's option, which everybody kind of thought they would. They've brought in Ryan Buddy as a minor league free agent for seemingly depth in AAA, and it looks as though the door is wide open for you to go in and snatch an everyday job in spring training.
Yeah, well, from our conversations and stuff like that, it's they've pretty much expressed that I'm going to have a chance and I'll have my opportunity. Wakamatsu came down, and we met for a day, and we're just starting to get a relationship, because he's going to be a big part of my development, and just started talking about pitchers and stuff like that, and now here in minicamp, we'll be working again together and starting to go over video and the little things that'll make a difference.
What do you think of this idea of the mini camp? This is something the Blue Jays have never done in Toronto before, but they're bringing up a bunch of you first weekend in January to work out here.
I'm excited. It's one thing. It's good. It's it breaks up the monotonous of just everyday, same thing, training and the stuff at home. I don't have kids. I'm a single young man, so it's kind of boring for me, other than working out and eating and sleeping. So it'll be cool to be able to go out there and then hang out with the boys and work and start, you know, getting that feel of spring training, because I know that a lot of us are biting at the bit.
Now, you're also a single young man from Miami who spent the last 2 years in Las Vegas. What are your thoughts about being in Toronto in January?
You know, I'm excited for the opportunity. When I first signed, I didn't know much about Toronto. I didn't know what to expect, and I went up there and signed my contract, and I fell in love with it. And then coming back and playing with, you know, playing this year, you know, the city's unbelievable. You know, the people are great. You know, the fans are great. You know, the food is great. You know, I really am a big fan of Toronto, and I'm looking forward to be able to start there this year and hopefully stay there for a long time.
With JPR and CBA, maybe my question would have better been, have you ever seen snow?
Yeah, I have seen snow, and I'm actually up in Tennessee right now because my sister brought up her kids to see snow for the first time, and there were like little flurries, and they thought it was a blizzard, so it was pretty funny.
Awesome. That's awesome. You'll probably see quite a bit of it when you get up here in January. JB, I want to talk to you about last year because we talked about you a lot last year. You're the most valuable player in the Pacific Coast League. Congratulations for that. You came up and had an amazing debut, and I talked to you at the end of the season about it because that was one of the memorable moments of the year. That whole weekend against Tampa, three phenomenal games back-to-back-to-back, and the middle one was you and the four hits and the double and the two home runs and the home run on the first pitch and you saw in the big leagues. Now that that's even farther away, 4 months ago, does it seem real? Do you look back and think, man, you know, what an incredible thing that you did?
Well, whenever you'll see the highlights or, you know, go over the plays of the year and well, you know, it'll happen to me in there and then, you know, I get some of the goosebumps and stuff like that. But honestly, it's just, you know, I'm past that as far as, you know, it was cool, but I don't want to be known for, you know, my debut. You know, I want to be known for, you know, a long career and helping teams win World Series. And that's my big thing. And so I'm just concentrating on what I have right now, which is, you know, the opportunity to, you know, to be an everyday guy and to help the team win. So it's a great accomplishment. You know, it's awesome, and it still gives me chills when I see it. But you know, I've had to move on from it.
All right, so let's talk about the rest of the year, because the rest of the year was kind of tough for you in that you didn't get a lot of playing time. When you did, let me ask you this. Do you know who the top four pitchers in the American League Cy Young voting were this year?
All my starts?
All your September starts. Every single one of your September starts came against a guy who finished in the top four in Cy Young voting in the American League this year.
Yeah, no, that was pretty fun. That was, especially, you know, like you said, it was tough because I was in a tough situation, you know, and that's out of my hands. And all I had to do was try to prepare in batting practice and front toss. But, you know, as far as Malave, was a good BP thrower, but I don't think he could emulate a 94-mile-an-hour cutter or a 97-mile-an-hour fastball from Felix Hernandez. So those at-bats were pretty fun. They were kind of more of a let's fight up there kind of at-bats than anything else.
I love that you're using the word fun, because I don't know that most people would. But yeah, Felix Hernandez, David Price, John Lester, CC Sabathia, those were your four starts in September.
You know what, honestly, what I did was, and I'm not a guy, I'm a very positive guy, and I'm all about, you know, having no negativity, and you know, my numbers don't show it, and my numbers, you know, I didn't get hits and all that stuff, but I took those at-bats as being able to see what they have and being able to prepare, because I knew, you know, I hadn't been hitting, I hadn't been playing, so my timing was going to be off, and, you know, it's tough already to hit when your timing's on every day, you know, especially when you're off for a week or off for a week and a half and you face a guy like that, it's tough. So I took those at-bats as preparing me, you know, for my, you know, this season to come and to see what they had. And so that I know that this year when I do face them and confront those pitchers, that I'm ready for them and know what they have.
We're with JPR and CBA. And yeah, that's part of the thing too, right? Because you mentioned Omar Malave throwing you BP. There is... there is no way to prepare for seeing that kind of level of a pitcher other than to get in there in the box against him.
No, of course. And you know, baseball is a thing where timing is everything. And, you know, in baseball, if you're off for a week or off for, you know, even a couple of days, sometimes I could throw your timing off and you can go from being an unbelievable hitter to, you know, just lost in the box. And you see it with a lot of guys when they come back from injuries. They haven't been, their game speed's not there, so it takes some time. So, you know, that made it extra difficult. And like I said, you know, I wouldn't get upset. You know, I wouldn't be bothered by the results. I was just more getting ready, using it as a preparation tool for the, you know, the year to come.
All right, before we let you go, the last thing I want to talk about is the work actually behind the plate. And we saw enough of your arm in the few opportunities where people were dumb enough to try to run on you that you have a very good-looking form back there and get the ball out of the glove quick and get it down to second base in a hurry. But what about calling a game? I found, and on the post-game show, hearing from people and whatever, some of these ridiculous notions that after the first three games you started in your major league career where the starting pitchers got lit up, there were people saying, well, yeah, he's got issues calling a game. Meanwhile, you caught some pretty fantastic games yourself down the stretch as well, where the pitchers were great. So I put no credence into, well, actually, I have no idea how you call a game because you've only made a handful of starts in the major leagues. How do you feel back there, and how do you feel your development is going in running a game and helping out a starting pitcher?
Well, you know, honestly, first, the people that say that, you know, about not being able to call a game are people that don't understand the game and don't really know the game. And I don't mean that as a shot to anybody, but, as far as the standpoint, it's one of those things where me and Ricky's talked about it, and me and Markham, you know, those guys, and you and me, you can go back there and call any pitch. At the end of the day, if they execute that pitch the right way down in the zone, they're going to have success. Now, you can call any pitch up there, and it could be the right pitch to call, but if they don't hit their spot, you know, and they don't, you know, then if they leave it up and that ball gets hit, you know, then, you know, that's their own fault as well. And it's that's something where pitchers know that as well. You know, if they keep the ball down, any pitch is good in any situation. Now, you know, there's a certain part of things that set up hitters and scouting reports and where to stay away and hitters' holes. But, you know, in my first three games, that's the way it happened. If I would have called the shutout in my first two games, they would have said, oh, this guy's unbelievable, you know, game caller. And if I would have gotten 0-15, they would have said, you can't hit in the big league. So
right.
It's just one of those things where it just happens. But, you know, people didn't. What I realize is, you know, I caught a game in Anaheim that we won 3-1, that Ricky threw, you know, 7 2/3, I think it was, and there's 7 innings, and he gave up a solo home run, and that was the only run of the game, and I caught a shutout against the Mariners, and I would have caught a shutout against Minnesota the last game, but I think we had an error, and the guy, it was an unearned run, so, you know.
Yeah, you caught a 2-1 loss in Tampa also. That was a great pitch game by Markham.
So for me, the biggest thing is you know, people, you know, don't see those things, and I don't get bothered by that. I know my abilities, and I know guys trust in my abilities. That's something I've always been good at. And I've had success, you know, in the minor league. We won a championship. When I was with the USA team, we won a gold medal, and that was all, you know, my game calling. And that's something that I take pride in. And obviously it's tough to gauge off of three games, and you know, people are going to say whatever they want to say, but, you know, it's, they'll be able to see, you know, that wasn't, you know, how it showed. It wouldn't show how I call a game as far as those three first games.
All right, glad to hear it. And one hopes that the people who don't know what they're talking about or who look at those three games and make any sort of determination aren't any of the decision makers that had to do with your next couple of months in the big leagues. I'm just not sure that how necessarily that worked, but it's all different now and a brand new start for you in 2011, and you're going to get a real opportunity, and we're really looking forward to seeing what you can do with this. Thank you for your time. Thanks for taking time out of the beast mode. Get back into it and kill the legs, and we'll see you in Dunedin.
Sounds good. Well, good talking to you, and look forward to it.
All right, there he is, J.P. Arencibia, the man who is going to be given every opportunity to be the Blue Jays' starting catcher in 2011, and the Jays hope for a long time beyond that. On the other side of this, we'll hear some Olympic audio. Take you back to Whistler. Welcome back. It is 10:23. -2. And as I look out at the Fan 590 Weather Center, it's overcast. It looks kind of foggy, just a dreary day. And that's kind of nice that most people don't have to work this week. And if you have the time off, enjoy it. If you don't, well, enjoy it when you get it. And enjoy looking back at 2010, because this is, now is a time of year where there's best of this and best of that. And we'll get into a little bit of that tomorrow. Well, again, as I mentioned, I'll be hosting the Greg Brady Show tomorrow from 1 to 3, and it will be our annual movie day. And we'll look at movies and sports and movies of the year, and it kind of meshes well this year because The Fighter is one of the top movies of 2010. My brother, Norman, will be in here tomorrow from 1 to 3. We will talk movies, take phone calls, and he is the lead film critic at Now Magazine. Used to be a film critic for the Toronto Star. So it's kind of become an annual tradition that we get together and we do this, and we'll have a good time. Right now, I'm going to join in with the whole look back in 2010 in sports and remember what was a phenomenal month, February, in Whistler, BC, for me. I got to cover all the stuff in Whistler. David Alter, who you just heard on the update, was up there with me, and the two of us kind of double-teamed that. Jeff Blair was there, too, and we'll talk to Blair a little bit later. But I wanted to replay a couple of the interviews, and, you know, I talked to everybody who was participating in any of those sports, all the medalists, all the Canadians. But the bobsleigh stands out to me because of the women's two-man and the 1-2 finish for Canada, gold and silver, in women's two-man bob. And Humphreys and Moyes get the pub because they took the gold. Helen Upperton and Shelly-Ann Brown won the silver. And one of them's local, Shelly-Ann Brown from just around the corner in Pickering. And here's the chat that Shelly-Ann and I had prior to the Olympics getting started about what she was looking forward to.
I wanted to talk to you specifically, well, first of all, about this whole experience, being at an Olympics, being at home, even though you're like half a continent away from home because you're from Pickering. But what's that been like for you?
It's been really incredible. Just leading into this season, sort of coming to grips with, wow, we're having a home Olympics. And it's really a once-in-a-lifetime, less than a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, you know, to have the Olympics in your home country and to have it in your home country at a time when you are able to compete. So really kind of hit the lottery a little bit that way. I'm so excited, and the support in Whistler and in Vancouver and just all across country has been incredible, and I'm so happy to see it.
Not only are you at home in an Olympics at a time where you're like the right age to compete and at the right spot in your career, but you're also at home in an Olympics where you have a very good chance to win a medal.
Yeah, that's also a really incredible thing, and it would just be sort of it would kind of be the cherry on top of the sundae for me if that's what happens, and that's what I'm really looking forward to. And, you know, beginning of this training season, I kind of had goals set out, and it was, you know, one step at a time, and so far things have gone pretty much the way I wanted them to. So I know I have a bunch of people back home hoping and cheering and, you know, rooting for me, and so I hope that we are able to do that. And I think that Canada is going to be able to really own the podium, actually. So
it certainly seems, at least, you know, in the bobsled and skeleton and luge, like there's a tremendous team put together. When you look back at the World Cup season that you and Helen had, what were some of the highlights for you, and did you accomplish, like, are you moving the way you wanted to be moving towards the games?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a difficult season, actually. It wasn't a season that was typical for anyone on the team. Definitely not for Helen and not for myself. The making the team as a brakeman was very difficult this year. We had a great class of brakemen, and it was tough, you know. And it was day in, day out, weekly proving yourself that you should be there, you can be there, and we all did. We all could have been there. So it was different, but also very good. And I do think that we are headed in the right direction, which is, okay, the World Cup season happened and it's over. And this is the Olympics. And it's, you know, it's 2 weeks of Olympic spirit, and get yourself and your mind and your body right, and let's go and let's do it. And you know, Helen said it in earlier, but it's at the Olympic Games, anything can happen, and we've seen it.
And we saw Helen last time in Italy finish fourth, and she talked about that as well. You weren't there. She missed the podium by 0.05 of a second. So I mean, do you think about how close she came and how much, you know, you have a chance to help her achieve what she couldn't last time?
No, actually, I don't actually really think about, her fourth place finish. I know it's a huge motivator for her. But for me, it's not really, because I don't think looking at your past near misses for me is not a motivator. The motivation is just trying to be better and better every day for yourself. And so for me, that's what it is.
All right, fair enough. The last question I got for you, Shelley, is just as a former sprinter, I mean, your elite athletic career before this didn't involve running for a very short distance and then putting your head down and going on a roller coaster. You know, it does that. What's the difference like for you, and how hard was it to get used to?
It was really hard to get used to. Everything in bobsleigh was like night and day from track and field. I mean, it's winter, it's cold. You know, I hate the cold. And yeah, you run and then you jump into this, you know, egg-shaped thing, and you put your head between your knees and it's shaking you around and you're like, I feel like I'm in a dryer. This is crazy. So it was, I was properly scared the first time I went down. I'll admit it. And I was for the first, probably the first four times I went down the track, I was like, oh, I made the wrong decision here. But in terms of actually the translation from being a sprinter to a good brakeman, it wasn't seamless, but it was a natural kind of progression. And many of the people on the team are from track and field because of the power and the speed that we have just from sprinting. It translates very naturally to pushing a sled quickly down an ice track. Who knew? So I've gotten used to it, and I do enjoy sliding now very much. And I make sure I learn the track very well so that I don't get scared inside the sled. And yeah, that's it.
Okay, I lied. This is the last question. You have a week until your event, a little bit more than a week till your event. How are you going to deal? I mean, we've all reached the point where, all right, let's get things going already, and the opening ceremonies are coming up, and you still have to wait. You practice, but you wait. How are you going to deal with that?
I think, well, Helen and I are going to go down to Vancouver just to try to get away from the Olympics, you know, because we still do, like you said, have a week to sort of like kind of narrow down our focus and still do the training and do the day-to-day grunt work that we have to do. You know, it's a lot more grunt than glory in this sport, let me tell you. So so we are going to do that and just sort of kind of cocoon ourselves a little bit, just so that we don't expend ourselves too much emotionally. And then we'll come back up to the village and jump right into the thick of things. And yeah.
All right, well, we can't wait either. Thanks so much for this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
There's Pickering Shelley Ann Brown, and she did come back and jump right into the thick of things and win a silver medal. And here's how she and her driver, Helen Upperton, sounded immediately after. Helen and Shelley Ann, silver medalists. Start with you, Helen. It's your second Olympic experience. Tell me what it was like to go through this one.
I had such a tough season. One medal, not where I wanted to be, and I like regrouped. I got great teammates that reminded me, you know, why I slide and how good I am. And we spent, I don't know, a couple of weeks getting ready for this and decided that no matter what happens, we're going to walk away saying we had a great time and we're proud to be here and proud to be Canadian at home at the Olympics. And I think that helped us get fast again. And we were fast, so.
Yeah.
You really were. And Shelley Ann, you climbed the ladder fourth to third to second, and you wind up with the silver.
Yeah, we're just so incredibly happy. Going 1-2 as Canada is a dream come true. This is a dream come true for me. I've been, since I was a little girl, wanting to be an Olympian. So I've been ready for this for 29 years, and I trained every day really hard all summer long. And when I stood on the block on the last day, like I had been envisioning for months and months, I was ready. and I knew that we could do it. And so proud to be Canadian, so happy. And I need to stop crying.
No, you don't. We're proud and happy too. Helen, just tell me in one little quick sentence, because you got to run. Doing it at home in front of these fans when you pulled up with the second best time and then watching Kaylee come in, all of that.
Yeah, I'm speechless. I mean, I can't see the clock. I had no idea what was going on. The only way I knew is because Shelly started hitting me on the head and there were people screaming, so I figured it had to be good or it would have been an awkward silence. So that's how I knew, and I don't know. I just felt like finally.
Helen Upperton and Shelly Ann Brown, Olympic silver medalists. I wanted to highlight the local athlete, Shelly Ann from Pickering. Of course, Heather Moyse and Kaylee Humphreys winning gold, and Canada finishing 1-2 there. A few days before, Canada was still without a medal in Whistler till John Montgomery took the gold.
John Montgomery, Olympic champion. Tell us how that feels.
It's got a nice ring to it. Definitely a phrase I can get used to hearing. It hasn't completely set in yet. I'm still listening to people cheer. And I'm beside myself.
You really are feeling a lot of the true patriot love here, huh?
Absolutely. You couldn't ask for a better audience to have the performance of your life in front of. My family's all here. I got lots of people from back home supporting me, and to be able to do them proud, I feel pretty honored.
You were chasing for three heats. What did it feel like getting into that start, this last heat, knowing that you had 0.2 to make up?
Honestly, I thought that was probably the best position for me to be in. To be out in front and have to maintain that lead, as we saw today, it's not easy to do. And to be able to come down second to last for myself, that's ideal.
When you were watching Martins on his last run, steadily losing time as he went down, what's going through your head? And then finally, when you saw that last time?
It was like I stuck my finger in a light socket. I was electrified when I saw the +7 come up, and I told myself that I'd try to be fairly stoic and respectful because you never want to cheer when somebody loses something. But I have to apologize because that didn't happen. I lost my mind.
First Canadian to pick up a medal in Whistler, and it's a pretty nice one. How does it feel to get the mountain monkey off this country's back?
Well, I don't know how big the mountain monkey was, but I'm happy to have removed it, so giddy up.
Giddy up indeed, and then about a half hour later, he's walking through Whistler. Someone hands him a pint of beer, and that's a shot that we will always remember. Little look back at 2010 and a fun time for this entire country with what happened up there in Vancouver and Whistler. Jeff Blair hosts this show, so we're going to have him on in the next segment. That'll be fun. And we'll reminisce about Whistler with him as well, because he was up there with me too.
Prices like no other, from a club like no other. The Fan Club. Join online at fan590.com.
Coming up on 10:43 on the Fan 590, it's the Jeff Blair Show. I'm Mike Wilner. After 11 o'clock, we will have a roundtable with ex-Jays Talk producers Ryan Walsh and Rob Pizzo. It's going to be a lot of fun. I have a feeling I'm going to take some shots, but that'll be all right. We'll bring Joe Cecilia in on it, too, and I can take a few more, I'm sure. As I mentioned, it's the Jeff Blair Show. Jeff Blair is supposed to be joining us right now. But evidently, Jeff takes these days off really seriously because we can't find him. So if he gives us a holler, we'll get him on the program. But while we look for Jeff Blair, we might as well just continue with the thread that we were on prior to the last break. Took you back to the Olympics, and we listened to Shelly Ann Brown, the silver medalist in the bobsleigh. John Montgomery, the gold medal winner in men's skeleton. Kaylee Humphreys and Heather Moyse won the gold in that women's two-man bobsled race. So let's hear from them not on the podium, but see what happens is they go on the podium, they stand there, they celebrate. this is right after the race, prior to the medal ceremonies, and then they walk through what they call the mixed zone, and that's where the media is, the reporters are. They do the TV people first. Then they talk to me and a bunch of foreign media, and then went around to the writers. So this is just a couple of minutes after they won gold, Kaylee Humphries and Heather Moyse.
Kaylee Humphries and Heather Moyse, Olympic champions. How's that sit with you, Kaylee?
It's amazing. It hasn't really sunk in yet. I'm trying to make it sink in faster. I really wanted to, but it sounds amazing. It felt amazing. I think it's, it's amazing.
So
I know.
To the general consensus, Heather, is that it's amazing.
It's pretty much amazing. Yeah, I concur. Yeah. It's right now.
My brain power on the track.
I can't even think of words. It's okay, forgive her. It's just right now, it's very surreal. I don't think it's hit either one of us yet. You know, you hear a Golden Girls World Champion and you're like, okay, yeah, those are just words. But I think we know that that's the case, but we don't feel it yet. And it's going to, we're exhausted. We're tired. We just did 2 days of racing straight in a row, double the amount that we usually do on any of our World Cup races. And I think that it's just overwhelming and exciting and proud to be part of that whole crew that's been cheering on the stands, and it's just awesome. It just feels really good.
Kaylee, just tell me, two track records, started out wire to wire. You guys had the best possible 2 days that anyone could have.
Yeah, that's been part of our plan, is just to blast it at the start and drive well. And I knew if we could do all those things, that it would be great. Oldenburg was the first time that we had, you know, a start record, a track record, and a win. And we had done that this season, so I knew it was possible. And yeah, you try not to focus on the little details, but more the actual,
the big picture,
yeah,
the perspective.
Yeah.
There they are, Golden Girls, as Heather Moyse said. Canadians were gold and silver in that women's two-man bob. Covering the Olympics up in Whistler really gave me an interesting opportunity. And that was in alpine skiing. And it was unfortunate what happened to the Canadians in alpine skiing, because there was so much expected and no results at all from both teams, the men, the women, the slalomers. Eric Gay had a couple of fifths, which were terrific, but Manny Osborne parody, a lot of people expected him to win gold because it was a course on which he grew up. Robbie Dixon as well, from around there. And neither of them even, you know, just going from memory, I don't think they made it through either one of their races. Both, when they had the opportunity, crashed out and didn't wind up anywhere close to the podium. But as you get into the Super Gs and the slalom races, the field really opens up quite a bit. And you see countries represented that you would never expect to see in a ski race. I mean, there was a racer from the Cayman Islands. There was one from Lebanon. Just the countries that come up kind of blow you away as far as, how did they have Olympic skiers when they don't have winter? Very strange, but maybe the strangest and perhaps the most interesting was royalty. In the men's slalom, it was Prince Hubertus von Hohenlohe who wound up finishing 46th out of the 48 skiers who finished the race. I think like 117 started. 48 of them finished. He finished 46th, and he was a very interesting interview. Here's my chat after his race with Prince Hubertus von Hohenlohe, skiing for Mexico.
First of all, tell me how you wind up representing Mexico at the Olympics.
I was born in Mexico. My father went there in the 50s and built the first Volkswagen plant there, so I was born there by chance. Then we moved to Spain, and he sent me to Austrian schools, and the only thing I ever saw was ski races. And so I thought, if you want to be cool, you got a ski race. So I bought Franz Klammer his downhill suit, and the next moment I was in the ski racing world.
And you find yourself in the Olympics at 50 years of age. That's pretty impressive.
51. Well, it's my first Olympic race since the downhill 1994 in Lillehammer. Well, it's a long time. They could have sent me a couple of times more, but they didn't. I kept on qualifying, and they had mercy with the old man, and they gave me one last chance.
What does it feel like for you to do this after 16 years between Olympics? How is it to be an athlete now?
It's cool. I mean, everything stays the same except of the fact that everybody tells you that you're the oldest. I'm just proud of having qualified and having kept on going after a couple of setbacks. And, you know, I live with a girl that has a place in Italy, in Cortina, and we train there with the kids. And they're bored, so they always want me to train with them. So I train, and here I am.
You looked exhilarated both times. You looked out of breath, but you looked like you were just so, so happy when you got to the bottom of the hill, accepting the applause from the crowd.
Well, you must know that I'm a downhill skier, and with 93, 4 kilos, to make those turns is really annoying, and I can't get around them so easy. And so I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And to at least have a good feeling coming down skiing and not feeling like a total idiot was great already.
Well, I guess if you make it down in one piece, you don't feel like a total idiot.
Yeah, but sometimes you feel like I could have gone better, I could have done this more and that more. But I really just skied to my sort of nearly 99% best, because it's difficult, you know, to ski any better. And if it would have been a shorter course, it would have been easy. I had to sort of, you know, take care of my power so that I don't go totally flat on the last two pitches, which are the difficult parts.
Okay, let me ask you lastly about being royalty. Tell me the story of how that works.
Well, what happens is that we are a principality in Germany called von Hohenlohe, and we kept the title since ever. But my family moved to Spain, and so we don't really have a castle over there right now. I mean, the family has it, but not us. And we're like Hanover or Bayern. I mean, we're just one principality of Germany, like Luxembourg, Liechtenstein. But we have united. Germany has been united. So there's a lot of different principalities, and they all stayed the same. You know, they all kept their titles.
So you are the prince of
Hohenlohe. That's a country. That's above Stuttgart. It's very beautiful. It's one of the jewels of Germany, really, to look at. It's not as famous as Hanover or Bayern or Württemberg, but it's very, very nice.
Well, it's a pleasure to get to speak to royalty, and it was great watching you come down that hill.
Thank you very much. I think I feel Canadian now with all this roar of the people.
Yeah, let me ask you about that before I let you go, just about the reception here in Canada and about having an Olympics here in Canada. What's it been like for you?
It's been great. I mean, Vancouver is really, really cool. The city's cool. It doesn't feel like winter, but it feels like a party, and like everybody wants to celebrate the athletes. They're very, very proud of us, and I have a great time. And the opening ceremony was rocking. Everything, I can just say it's great. I mean, the weather sometimes goes a bit bust, but the rest is cool.
All right. Thank you very much.
So there he is, Prince Hubertus von Hohenlohe, one of the more enjoyable characters there in the Olympics. And, of course, as much fun as it is to look back on what happened in Vancouver and in Whistler at the Olympics, can't really take a look back without looking at the first story that unfortunately I had to cover when I got there. Opening ceremonies were the big deal, and I was supposed to have a day off to just watch and listen, and then I found out that Nodar Kumaridashvili had been killed in a training accident in Luge. Jeff Blair was there watching, and I ran up to the track, to the sliding center, to the track, where the day before I had been watching guys go off their sleds on practice runs and thinking it was really cool. It gives you a real different thought process about that. Here's a quick snippet of my conversation with Jeff Blair right after he had seen the accident.
Well, Jeff, tell me, first of all, what'd you see?
Well, I was at the finish area, and I was looking at, actually watching it on the big monitor that they have at the finish area, and saw the slider go off his sled and appear to hit the pole back first. And I mean, it was pretty, I've covered a few World Cup races and stuff now, and when you're at the finish line, you can tell when something's serious because of the way the competitors react, because a lot of the competitors hang around to get their sleds weighed, and and all that stuff. And as soon as he flew into it, I mean, well, you could tell, obviously, that it was serious, but also just some of the veteran riders like Albert Demchenko from Russia, who's a guy who slides on the edge. I mean, they were just, you know, they were beside themselves, and you knew right away that, you know, obviously it was a serious accident. That part of the track, it's there are so many areas in this track. This is the fastest track in the world. If you were going to pick an area where that would happen, that's probably not the area. You would pick one of the turns farther up the track in turn 13 or something like that. This is essentially a straightaway going towards the finish line. And anyhow, so we managed to get down to trackside. The slider actually flew off the sled, hit the squared metal pole, and fell onto essentially like a pedestrian walkway going alongside the track. And we were there, and there was an ambulance at the scene immediately, and they were performing CPR on him. They had a plastic tube shoved in his mouth, and they were feverishly working on him, and they shooed us all away. But, I mean, it was pretty clear. And some of the track officials who were there were, you know, were crying and sobbing. And, I mean, it was pretty clear that it was a serious accident.
And they still were when I got there a couple of hours after the accident. That's Jeff Blair talking about the tragedy that kicked off the 2010 Winter Olympics, the passing of Nodar Kumaritashvili in an accident on the luge track. And it's tough to end that way, but you know what? We're going to have a lot of fun after the top of the hour with a roundtable of former Blue Jays pre- and post-game producers.